one. Okay, so today what I'm going to do is start with a thermodynamic starting place. So I'll just start off hopefully where Lars ended yesterday, and then talk about starting to solve some of these thermodynamic parameters for equations of state of materials' constitutive properties. Okay, so just so that you can see where this will be coming from, here's my statement of the first law. Okay, so here I'm writing an exact differential of energy is equal to two non-exact differentials, the heat done minus the work done. In a closed system in which there's no exchange with the surroundings, we can write a combined statement of the first and second laws of thermodynamics. And here I've written it in differential form, where the internal energy is the sum of a heat term, which is TdS, and then a series of work terms that now add to the total internal energy. And I've written the work terms generally here as the product of conjugate variables, intensive and extensive properties of the system. And we can then go and interrogate our system and say, what are the relevant conjugate variables that we want to use? So we have the work terms, x and y. And they have the property that when you multiply x and y, they have the units of energy or energy density. So they're contributing to the overall internal energy. So doing thermodynamics just amounts to integrating this combined statement of the first and second laws. So in general, in order to be able to integrate an equation like that, we need the functional forms of all of our conjugate variables and how they depend on all of the other variables. So I can write it in this longhand. In order to be able to integrate, we need how temperature depends on entropy and all of the extensive work functions and how the intensive function 1 depends on entropy and everything else. Okay? So we need all of those functional forms in order to be able to fully integrate the equation. That turns out to be, of course, very difficult. So from a practical point of view, which everything that we're doing is, because we actually have to make measurements and extract real numbers, a practical approach would be to do a series expansion for each conjugate pair of variables, x and y, do a series expansion around a convenient reference state, okay, and then expand out in several orders of derivatives, okay? So a couple of points. In general, they're names given for when we decide to truncate after the series of terms in our expansion. If we truncate after the first term, that's just the linear approximation. We're going to look at that. If we keep a second term, which is now a squared term, that's called a harmonic approximation. And if we allow it to have a third term and beyond, those are what's known as anharmonic contributions to the energy function. So that's where those terms comes from the truncations in our series expansion. Okay? So when we're approaching a problem, from a practical point of view, we now have choices. Okay? And our choices are twofold. And they're simple to state. We have one choice, and that is we can pick whatever reference state we want. Okay? And our second choice is that we can choose our pairs of intensive and extensive variables to have whatever properties that we want in the expansion. And yesterday when Lars talked about thermodynamics, he showed the thermo box, how you could get all of the different kinds of internal and free energies by exchanging the conjugate variables with each other through these Legendre transformations. We're allowed to do that because energy is exact. So that gives us a lot of power. We can choose exactly how we want to perform this expansion. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through this expansion twice, okay? The first time, we're going to look at elastic energy. So what happens when we squeeze a sample without worrying about thermal effects? And I'm going to make the choices for you. Actually, I didn't make the choices. Francis Birch made the choices in the 40s or in a series of people. But I'll show you how those choices lead to a definition of energy that we can now use to say something about materials. Then we're going to step back to this expansion, and we're going to ask as a group, what properties do we want for a pressure, temperature, volume? And even as I use those words, pressure, temperature, volume, I'm automatically telling you perhaps what you might choose as properties for a thermal equation of state. But we're going to back off, and I'll poll you. What do you think the properties should be of a series expansion that will encompass the thermal and elastic energy of materials in the Earth? And then we'll see how we could do it in practical terms. Okay, so mechanical equations of state. Great, so I've rewritten now my combined statement of the first and second laws, now just including one kind of work, and this is mechanical work. So this is in some ways a review of what we've seen before, but I think that these things are always nice to see a couple of times. So we have the internal energy in a differential form is just the mechanical work terms. So this is our stress tensor and our strain tensor. Okay, and now we're going to go ahead and do our Taylor expansion. Okay, so we can expand out the stress tensor as a reference state plus higher order terms. And remember, these are tensors, so I wrote a very simplified notation for the higher order terms. We actually have to expand out each of those components. But I kept the double bars to indicate that they're tensors, and I'm cheating a little bit here. Okay. So now if we say, okay, we're just going to do the linear approximation, let's truncate those higher order terms, and what we're left with is Hooke's law. Okay, and so this is a starting elasticity model for seismology. Okay, it's a linear approximation, and the strains are infinitesimal. They're very small. We're going to come back to the definition of strains in a second. But I wanted to make a point, again, that we have a six-component stress tensor. And you think that there are three spatial directions, and then in each direction you have a component normal, okay, and you have a component parallel. So that gives you your six directions. So six components to the stress tensor, six components to the strain tensor, and then we have a 36-component constitutive tensor, which are our elastic moduli. Okay. Now, for a material that's in equilibrium, that is, du is equal to zero, no strain energy can be added or subtracted to the system, that 36-component tensor becomes symmetric, and we're left with our 21-component elastic properties. Okay, so I just wanted to review quickly the number of elastic, independent elastic moduli will change based on the symmetry of the system. And these are single crystal symmetries. So if you can imagine a block of a triclinic material, it will have 21 independent elastic components. And as we go to increasing symmetry, our number of independent components just decreases. And just for your reference, I put some rocks that you might be familiar with. So these are actually crustal. I shouldn't have put rocks. I should have put minerals here. Crustal minerals are in general very low symmetry. They're triclinic and monoclinic. Mantle perovskite is orthorhombic. The transition zone consists of mostly cubic materials. Important point to note here, and this is a very, very common misunderstanding, is that just because a material is cubic doesn't necessarily mean that it's elastically isotropic. And the source of confusion might be if you've studied optical mineralogy, in which a cubic material is optically isotropic. But in the case of elasticity, because we have a much larger tensor for constitutive properties, it turns out that there are actually three independent elastic constants for a cubic material. And only when you take a bunch of different materials and orient them randomly, like a rock, then you get two independent elastic constants. Okay, now the elastic constants, they're independent, but we can choose them however we want. We can say, oh, we want two elastic constants to be orthogonal to each other. So for example, one will be the volume change, contain the volume change information, and the other will contain the shape change information. Or we can say that we want the Lamé constants, so what looks easiest mathematically are lambda and mu. Or we can say that we're mechanical engineers and we're used to pulling bars in a tension test, and then we're going to want the Young's modulus, which comes out. That's the length change as we pull a bar in a uniaxial load and Poisson ratio. Okay, so we can choose our independent elastic constants however we want, and then when we go back to do our series expansion, we have to make sure that we keep our choices consistent. Where? Here? Here? Right. Hooke's law, right, what I do is I assume a zero reference state. And then just take this is Hooke's law here. Because the change in the stress with respect to strain are the constitutive properties. So I assume a zero, an unstrained reference state. But we can pick it wherever we want. We can start with something that's already smushed and then expand linearly from there. But there are general ways of looking at strain, and that's what... Yep. Yes. It has 81 if you... Okay, so what I did a trick, right? Okay, our sigma ijs have 9 in general, right? When they have all their 9, then the CIJKs have their 81. But I already said that these are symmetric, and so I skipped a step. Yeah. So that's where that comes from. Okay, so let's look about how we define strain. And I'll start with something that I'm familiar with, and you're probably familiar with, and that's just our linear definition of strain. Okay, we take a bar, it's attached to a wall, it has a length, we pull on it, the length changes. So we have our original length, L naught, our expanded length, L. Strain is just the difference in length divided by the original length. So this is a engineering definition of strain. Okay. And this is an infinitesimal strain. We can write a more general definition by now looking at finite strain. And so this is, again, I'm repeating something that we've already seen, which is a body, this black blob in three-dimensional space, being deformed in general to another blob. Okay. So I can define two points in my first blob, P and Q, okay? And they're just close together. And they're just my reference points. And there's a little vector that attaches the two, which is ds, okay? And now when they deform, the points go to two different places in now the deformed purple blob, P prime and Q prime. And they're separated by a vector s prime, okay? So in order to quantify the strain, the object is to find S minus S prime. Okay, so that's this general equivalent to this one-dimensional engineering strain. Now to do that is a lot of bookkeeping mostly, and so what I'm going to do is start you off to see the bookkeeping process and then wriggle my fingers a lot. Okay, so what we do is we write our undeformed points. P is some coordinate in space. Q is this coordinate plus our S vector that takes us from P to Q. And then we're going to write the coordinates in the deformed space. So our P prime is this P plus this deformation vector that takes us into deformed space. And then Q prime we can write as some combination of all of these. Now as we're putting together our bookkeeping, our notation of how we deform something in space, we're going to have two options, okay? And that is, how do we choose our coordinate system to represent our deformed space? And there are definitions of these two different coordinate systems that you can use. You can reference everything to our original P and Q reference state, and that's called a Lagrangian coordinate or an unstrained reference frame. Okay, in which our strained state is written as a function of our unstrained state. However, if we have a lot of strain and we want to keep track of how things are going, we can have a coordinate system that's actually moving as we're straining something. So we can reference everything to our strained coordinate state. And the definition of that is called a Eulerian strait of strain. And that's a strained reference frame. So now we write our unstrained state as a function of our strained state, now which is our reference state, and we subtract the displacement. Okay. In deriving how we develop the energy state of materials, of deep earth materials, and Birch's great leap was deciding to use the Eulerian after years and years and years of people getting messed up in the mathematics of using Lagrangian. And I actually don't know how he did it, except it must have been just an intellectual leap, because it made things a lot simpler. So what I'm going to do now is switch to a Eulerian reference frame and then start to develop a finite strain equation of state that way. Okay, so in general, we can write a total displacement field. Okay, so the total deformation is the sum of two distinct parts. So the displacement field is the sum of a strain tensor, okay, which is all of the shape and volume change of that blob, plus we can separate out the rigid body movements of this blob. So in general, we have translations, rotations, and shape change, okay, and volume change. Okay, so now we're going to throw away our rigid body translations and rotations, because they don't really contribute to the overall energy, and we're just going to take a look at this internal strain. And again, there's a lot of arithmetic to go through, so it can be shown that you can write the Eulerian finite strain now as this displacement field. You might be used to seeing this as a delta ij term. And then here, we're keeping cross terms, okay? And that's what the finite strain does, is it keeps the second order strain field in the whole strain formulation, okay? Now, we can separate this Eulerian finite strain again into two parts. We can say, let's just take a strain that is completely volumetric, just the volumetric component of the strain, so only the strain that contributes to volume change, and throw away the shape part, and then we'll take all of the shape change and put it into another tensor. Okay, so we can separate the strain that way. And I won't show you how that's done, because I didn't get to do it last night. But so right now what I'm going to do is take the shape change, okay, part, and we're going to revisit that when I talk about transport properties, because it turns out it's these shape change stresses and strains that are the driving force for mass transport. And so we're going to return to those in my next lecture, I think, which will be Monday. And for now, I'm just going to keep the hydrostatic component. Okay. And what's nice about the hydrostatic component of the strain and stress is that they're scalars, okay? It's one number that relates the hydrostatic component of the stress and the strain, and that's the materials bulk modulus. Okay, so now we're going to talk about Birch's equation of state. The idea was to look at the internal energy of a system and then talk just about the strain contribution to that energy. And now I'm going to specifically talk about only the volumetric strain contribution to the total internal energy of a system. So Birch's idea was that we're going to take now our energy and strain and expand it out in terms of strain. So this is our Taylor expansion of energy that we're then going to solve, and we're doing it in terms of volumetric strain. Okay? So I'm writing E as a general energy, but you know from the thermodynamics lecture that we can choose what energy we're going to deal with. So if we do it on an isentrope, if we hold an entropy constant, then it's the Helmholtz energy, or we can hold temperature constant, it's the internal energy. Okay? So we're going to expand an energy of choice now in terms of strain. Okay. The Eulerian finite strain, the volumetric component of the Eulerian finite strain, okay, the hydrostatic component, is related to the volume change by this definition. And this comes out of more math of the strain definitions on the page before. Okay, so this is our Eulerian finite strain definition. And you notice that as pressure goes up, the strain is going down. But it's more convenient to think in terms of actual pressure, strain, energy, adding energy to our system. So Birch redefined the strain as a minus strain, minus F. So here's our strain definition right here, and that's in the Eulerian coordinate system, and it's a finite strain definition. Okay. So now what we're going to do is we're going to take our strain energy and expand it as a Taylor expansion about small strains. So we have a constant plus a squared term plus a third order term, fourth order term. Okay? And now remember, we want the strain energy to add, the strain to add to our energy. So we're going to substitute F minus strain. And then we have the same terms, but now we have a minus sign that substitutes in. Okay? So here's the energy of the system that is donated by straining it volumetrically. Okay, so now we're going to play a couple tricks. The first one is that we can write pressure is as the change in energy with respect to volume, holding either temperature, entropy constant, and definitely keeping our chemistry constant also. This is just from thermodynamics. Okay. So here's our pressure in terms of how energy changes as a function of volume. And now we can use the chain rule and say that the change of energy as a function of F times dF dV is the same as this. Okay? So now we have partial derivatives, and I've left off all the constants here, but they should be understood that all of the we choose either constant entropy or temperature, and we're not dealing with chemistry at all. Okay? So we can now take the derivative of our strain with respect to volume, and we get this. Okay, and that just takes a little bit of algebra to do too. Okay, so now here's our pressure in terms of strain. Now we could take the partial derivative of energy with respect to finite strain. And I've done that here. Okay, so now our C naught drops out. We have another constant. Now remember, these are our harmonic and anharmonic terms, and they're kind of scooting over towards the front of the energy expansion. Okay, so now when we just substitute this into here, we get a relationship between pressure and strain, okay, that's now expanded out, okay, and I've kept the first two terms, and these constants are now the bulk modulus and the derivative of the bulk modulus with respect to pressure defined at our reference state, which I'm choosing to be room pressure. Okay, so this is the derivation of the third order Birch-Moynihan finite strain Eulerian equation of state. It's like come from a fancy kennel.
Did K' come out of the analysis, or did K' go into the assumption about how the bulk modulus changed with pressure? In other words, does the theory tell you that it has to be linear in P, or is that earlier?
No, it doesn't have to be linear in P, because there are terms out here that talk about how these guys, bulk and shear, change with higher order pressure terms. So when I've truncated here, then I've assumed that this is constant, I think.
Actually, even to this order, K' will change with pressure.
Oh, that's right. Okay, that's another way. That's right. That's another way of putting it. In fact, we'll see it that... Remember, I mean, this is very powerful. We can expand pressure out in terms of strain, but we can also go back and expand bulk modulus out in terms of strain. We could expand K prime in terms of strain, okay? So...
Pressure is originally kind of data C2, so K prime is 4.
Ray, if you truncate here, k prime has to be 4. Okay, if this term is 0, then you solve and k prime is 4. And that's often a starting place for people's, okay? So Birch didn't grab this out of the air, okay? And he was also at a time where you couldn't take, for example, perovskite or MgO and access the high enough pressures to actually see the finite strain taking place. So in order to be able to compare it to an actual observation, empirical theory, he took rock salt, halite, as his model for an earth material, okay? And it turns out that because rock salt is so soft, when you so here's our V over V naught versus P, okay? And in those days, there was a limited pressure range over which you can actually squeeze a material. So let's call it 30 kilobars, okay? I'm not behind the screen, am I? Okay. So if we took, for example, Pericles, MgO, and squeezed it to 3 GPa, or 30 kilobars, it would look like this. And we'd say, oh, Hooke's law is doing just great. Thank you very much. Okay. But what his leap was that there was a huge amount of experimental data on a standard material, salt, and it looked like this. I'm exaggerating, but it had a certain curvature to it. Hooke's law definitely didn't apply. Okay. And so what he did was he developed this theory to account for this behavior of salt. Okay. And then he said, oh, well, the pressures in the earth are so large. Okay, let's use salt over this limited pressure range as a behavior for MgO to a very high pressure range. And we'll use this formulation to extrapolate rather than our linear extrapolation, which is going to give us the totally wrong answer. Okay, so that's how in 1952 Birch came up with a model of the whole Earth based on inferences from a very soft material and measurements of a very limited range of earthly materials. Mike, yeah. I haven't gone back and looked at those formulations, but I do know that, like in later papers, people complained that it was hard and there were a lot of errors. I mean, my guess is that it doesn't fall out as nicely. Okay. Right. Okay. Right. And in fact, when we back off, I want to show you some examples of how this is used in practice. So we're going to take bulk moduli of materials and perturb them and see how that compares with wave velocities in just a second. But when we now step back to look to say, okay, well, let's start from scratch again. And this is scratch right here. Okay. Here's scratch, where we haven't chosen our conjugate variables at all, nor have we chosen our reference state, okay? Nor have we made any choices about what's going to happen to these constant terms as we expand out. We're going to come back and ask the question, well, what do you want your terms to look like? Okay, so I guess Guy's answer, yeah, that's right. I mean, if you say, well, I want my terms to damp out really quickly as we expand so I can truncate at third order, and I'll be okay. then that would be the, that's what the Eulerian strain did for birch over the Lagrangian strain.
I think again, it's just because most people have, most of them have tape line close to four, so that third zone is usually pretty small.
That's right, that's right.
And then you have the next zone, which is even higher over the strain, so it's not like
Is Angio ionic?
Oh, yes. They're both ionic, and in fact, they have the same exact structure. I forgot to make that point. Yeah, it's both the same structure, and they're ionic. And I mean, the theory for ionic materials, you know, how you look at the potential forms of the attraction potential and the repulsion potential, and then how you sum up those forces in space as you take two ions together, that was all developed for sodium chloride. So there's a huge body of condensed matter physics literature on that material. Okay. So, just for fun, I decided to write a quick forward code to look at only bulk modulus right now, because I developed it only for bulk modulus. I'll tip my hand and tell you that bulk modulus is a little bit easier to measure than shear modulus, so we actually have a lot more data for bulk modulus under pressure and temperature conditions. That's why I chose that. And what I did was I used Birch-Moynihan equation of state to now extrapolate these quantities, the relationship between pressure and volume, density, strain, to extrapolate to high pressures. Okay. So this is for perovskite. Okay. This is density as a function of pressure. And what I've done is take three cases. The first one is using what had been an accepted bulk modulus for perovskite, determined by X-ray diffraction for many years, of about 264 GPa with a K prime again of 4, so that truncates the third term of the expansion. Okay, so here's how density increases with pressure. This is all room temperature right now. Okay. Just over the last few months, there was a new measurement that came out, a measurement of the bulk modulus of perovskite by Brian scattering data that got a much lower number for bulk modulus. So now it's 252. And I kept the same K prime, but now, and I assume that the density is the same, our starting off point, so the solid line tells you, the solid black line, is the difference just between these two bulk moduli on the density versus pressure scale. Okay? This is now bulk modulus expanded as a function of pressure. Okay? And here's the high bulk modulus, and then the new measurements, lower bulk modulus, expanded out with pressure. The way it expands out with pressure, the lines are parallel to each other because our DKDP is the same in both cases. Okay? And then just to compare it with an expected seismic wave velocity, I calculated P wave velocity. Remember, this is cold, so it's faster than PREM, for example, in the lower mantle. And then I had to assume some shear modulus. So I just pulled a value up, 175, and gave it a pressure dependence. But that's kept constant the whole way. And really, right now, I'm just looking at differences. When I perturb bulk modulus, what happens to seismic wave velocities? Okay? Okay, so one of the points that I wanted to make is in this Birch-Moynihan equation of state, the constants in front of each term are not orthogonal. They're dependent on each other. Okay? So K, bulk modulus, and K prime have trade-offs with each other. So what I wanted to show here was how I could keep now a lower bulk modulus and increase the derivative with pressure just a little bit so that the density now comes back down to the original density. And actually, I perturbed this just a little bit more than necessary so that you can see the dotted line underneath. Okay, so it's a very, very small change in DKDP that from a density diagram we would never be able to tell the difference between a bulk modulus of 265 and 255. Okay, the difference between these two are larger than error bars commonly cited for that kind of measurement for Brillouin spectroscopy and also for X-ray diffraction. But remember, when you're doing an X-ray diffraction measurement, what you're measuring is density. So you could see, if you have a series of points on this lower combination black dotted line, okay, that you could just as easily choose an equation of state that had a high bulk modulus and a low derivative with pressure, as you could choose a lower bulk modulus with a higher derivative with respect to pressure. So that's a challenge. That's an experimental challenge. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. Okay?
So is this factor for VK or VP? So you're saying it's independent of the material, for most materials,
it's actually not. 4 is convenient because if you assume that the finite strain expansion is converging tightly when that term truncates, by definition K prime has to be 4. But for materials, deep earth materials, people measure a range of 3 to 6 or 7, and for crustal materials and for liquids, then the range becomes even larger. Okay. Right, or reformulate the equation of state, which lots of people do. It's kind of a rite of passage for mineral physicists. Okay, so now let's add in temperature. Okay, so I just wanted to make one more point. So this is the type of error bars that we would get when we measure an X-ray diffraction bulk modulus, an equation of state. Just the PV term. It's also the order of magnitude of what happens when you add, for example, aluminum into your perovskite. You get these same changes in bulk modulus and then some density changes that, when you drop the curve up or down, it looks, has that same type of difference to it. So chemistry substitutional changes in a structure have this type of difference in looking at a velocity. Okay, now let's do temperature because we really have to see, well, what's going to happen when we add in temperature. So we have a thermal expansion, and when we talk in a couple minutes about PVT equations of state, I'll show you exactly the thermal equation of state that I used to do these calculations. It's a simple one. But thermal expansion decreases with pressure in general. And I've picked 3 cases. This is now the original case. And here what I've done is chosen this lower value of bulk modulus as my cardinal value. And now I'm going to look at what happens when we change thermal expansion. Okay. So here I have a high value of thermal expansion. It's a very floppy material. And here's an intermediate value of thermal expansion. And they both decrease with pressure in the same way. What I've done is I've held the product of thermal expansion and bulk modulus constant. Okay, so that as bulk modulus is increasing with pressure, thermal expansion is decreasing, so that together they're the same. And that's a first order approximation. Okay, so here's our density at room temperature. And now we have a temperature that's 2,000 degrees higher than room temperature. And here's the new density for high thermal expansion material and low thermal expansion material. Okay. So this density difference now, okay, it's quite a bit larger than these density differences here. Okay, so temperature makes a big, has a big role. Okay. Yes, yeah, I'm just using a constant temperature right now. Because what I'm more interested in is perturbing each variable in turn and seeing how that works. So, yeah, so temperature is constant. And so here are the calculations now for how the wave speed is reduced as a function of temperature. You can see that for a pure perovskite mantle, we're not even coming close to measured velocities, although there's a lot of play in the shear I haven't touched that yet. No. Well, the bulk modulus does. Yes, the bulk modulus does, because I have constant temperature, but the bulk modulus and thermal expansion are constant, so that is changing with temperature. But not the shear. Okay, so that's a big effect. But I'm not looking at that right now. Okay, great. So now we've looked at measurement errors, small perturbations in chemistry, and temperature. So now let's look at phases. Okay, so now what I've done. Yeah.
So does the coefficient of thermal expansion?
I'm just looking at a constant temperature, and here's my PVT equation of state. It's a little embarrassing. One second.
I guess I'm not familiar with this stuff, but I was thinking that the effect of this, that the coefficient of thermal expansion is sort of a constant of the differential.
What I'm doing is I'm taking a practical approach to a thermal equation of state, and I'm saying that we can take the pressure and divide it into an isothermal term plus a thermal pressure effect, okay? And that this is my Birch-Moynihan equation of state that I had done before, and now I can choose a thermal pressure however I want. And the way I'm doing it is just taking this first term in an expansion, assuming the alpha k is constant. So there's temperature and pressure dependencies built in there, but this is very much, I call it, you know, it's an experimentalist prerogative. It's a very practical approach, and it doesn't, you know, it's not a, yep, there are problems with it. But from an experimental point of view, where we want to just measure a volume and see what the effect of thermal pressure or thermal expansion is, it works just fine. And as it turns out, experimentally, we can't resolve between any choices of how we formulate that equation of state. But this has a whole series of assumptions built in with how thermal expansion changes with pressure and temperature, how the cross terms change with pressure and temperature, and you know what happens. I mean, this is all built in when we truncate these higher order terms in this expansion. But that's how I do it. Okay, so let's see, what did I do here? Okay, so now I'm all at high temperature, at 2,000 degrees. And so my cardinal is the perovskite, 252, with a K prime of 4, okay? I have this high value of thermal expansion, but it is decreasing with pressure and temperature. And I'm just looking at a constant temperature of 2,000. That's this black line here. Okay, now I've raised the temperature by 500 degrees, and this is my new density and new velocity. Okay, now I've said, well, let's mix in some periclase. Let's take MgO and see what that looks like plotted on the same plot. So MgO has a bulk modulus much lower, about 160 GPa, and I've also assumed K prime of 4. And a lower shear modulus, which I've expanded out with pressure in the same way. and it has a thermal expansion too. So this is a high temperature equation of state. And the thermal expansion is 3 times 10 to the minus 5. And I make the same assumptions for the thermal expansion of MgO. The bottom line is that MgO is much lower density and has a much lower bulk modulus. So that just by adding MgO, we completely change the balance of the contributions to the total wave speed velocity. I didn't add anything. This is pure MgO. This is pure perovskite, and you could add it with your eyes. And so, the point is that small changes in temperature are going to move you here. Okay? Changes in substituting aluminum, for example, or changes in measurements of our bulk modulus or how it depends with pressure, they're going to move you in this kind of a range. Okay? But when you add a little bit more MgO, you start to ask, what's the balance of the major element chemistry at the mantle? That's when you have to really start looking at the constraints. So basically, this is another way of getting at one of Bruce's conclusions, which is, yeah, thermal expansion is important, thermal conductivity is important, all of these things are important, but when you step back and you ask the fundamental question, what's down there and how much? That's where the real meat of the problem is.
So what if you were to take entire life and decompose it into
Rostec? People do these. Every paper by Jay Bass, when they come up with a new number for bulk modulus of a material, they'll reformulate all of the compositions in the mantle. So I haven't done that here. Your program does that too, right?
Yeah, and it ends up agreeing quite well, probably with an experimental uncertainties. And I know you know this, Abby, I just don't want people to leave with the wrong impression. The bottom figure looks like a 50-50 mix of perovskite and magnesiosite is the mantle, but that wouldn't work, because if you take into account the effect of temperature on the shear modulus and the effect of iron on the density, perovskite is going to end up agreeing almost perfectly.
Right. Basically, this was a model designed to perturb input variables and see what happens to the output. And I started it, this morning. This was my personal tutorial. And if I spend 6 years on this model, like Lars and Carolina did on theirs, I would get their model out at the other end. So I think that's what happens, right? But they did it, so I don't have to. Thank you. Thank you. Okay.
What is density higher on the top local bar at higher temperature?
Well, that's a good question. I must have mixed the two colors. I'll have to go back and look. Yeah, the density should definitely be lower. But I might have mislabeled it, or I could have added my alpha KT term. That could have also happened. Yeah. Okay. Great. So now we're going to do a group exercise. This will be fun. Okay, let's start. We're going to develop a thermal complete equation of state together. We're not really. We're just going to talk about what properties we'd like it to have. Okay? So I've written our energy as a function of a thermal term plus work terms. And I've left completely open what those work terms could be. So I'm backing off of my Lagrangian state of stress. I'm backing off my insistence that it be hydrostatic. I'm backing off even that there's strain energy involved. Okay, we just have work and heat. We have to pick conjugate variables such that the constants in front of our expansions have specific properties. Okay, and we can ask, what do we want those properties to be like? Okay, and I want you guys to give me what you want the properties of those to be like. And I have some ideas just in case you need some warming up. Okay. Then we need to do a series expansion around a convenient reference state. Okay, and so the second question that I have is, what reference state do you want? Okay, and then we'll solve it, but we won't do that. Okay, so let's talk about reference state first. What reference state would you like? What properties would you like to have in a reference state? Okay, that's a good one. Surface of the Earth. Anyone else have an idea for reference state?
Would that mean, like, is that zero GPU in the cloud or something? Or is that pretty
easy? Okay, well, we can choose adiabat. Or P equals 0, T equals 300. Or we can have it vary if we need it to. Okay? Those are two. Which do you want to do? Well, okay, adiabatic. Mantle adiabat. This is exactly what I want you to think about, because we have options, right? And that the idea is to start thinking about what kinds of properties that you'd like to see in equations of state, and that way when you see new ones that are done a little weird, you'll have a framework to put it in. Oh, you know, he just expanded did a series expansion around the mantle adiabat, so you can get an equation of state that way. Wherever you do experiments. Experiments are usually ambient, but they could be in other places also. You could expand it around a Hugonio if you're a shock person. That'd be scary. We could come back to it. Okay, now let's talk about the constants in front of our series expansion. These are the constitutive properties, I guess. What properties would we like the constitutive properties to have? Well, we could say we want them all to be non-dimensional. We all want to be, you know, geophysicists, and we want all non-dimensional constitutive properties. We could do that. We could want to be elegant, for example, and we say we want our terms to be orthogonal. Okay? So we could say that they're orthogonal. Yes. Yeah. Basically, they're distinct. There are no trade-offs between the terms. Good one. And that's actually converge. That's actually the biggest. That's the biggest criticism of many of the equations of state that we use, that they don't converge. They start blowing up when we look at Jupiter or sometimes even the Earth's core. It's a little, but that's the convergence is a good one. We can expand it so we can pick our terms. So for example, we can do whatever expansion is necessary so that the physical parameters that we're looking at, instead of bulk modulus and shear modulus, we can expand so that we're expanding in terms of shear wave velocity and P wave velocity. So,
is that possible?
To have it without it blowing up?
Taylor series expansion. Power series. How could that not blow up?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, if you choose your reference state, it's a very high pressure limit. I can bring it back to the way. Why don't we know enough about minerals so that we can have a mathematical form that represents what they're likely, what their properties are likely to do?
But
some range where, you know, this is a process, right? You have, you fit some region of data to a polynomial, and outside the region where you fit it, it pairs off.
You're absolutely right. And so a lot of the effort went into choosing what the expansion variable to use in such a way that the divergence was limited over the range of interest, over the range of pressure of interest. And the Eulerian finite strain just happens to work out pretty well that way. It converges rapidly. We extrapolate low pressure experimental data to four pressures. It doesn't blow up. It matches the Fibonacci, et cetera. Now, one of the interesting questions is, you know, why does the Eulerian strain work? Some of the Lagrangian strain. The Lagrangian strain doesn't work. We don't have any answer to that. And one of the reasons we don't have an answer to that is, as Lagrange said, there's no physics in that field of series expansion. It's just what happens to work. You mentioned experimental data. And the reason there's no physics in it is because the physics is complex. It goes into, it comes back to the shape of that repulsive wall that you encounter when two atoms start to overlap with each other. The functional form of that is unknown and probably very complicated. And what you have to do is solve the Schrödinger equation of the charge density of each atom and how it forms the overlap zone. So very complex physics that we just don't know, even for something relatively simple like mine. We can solve Schrödinger's equation and calculate it, but it's there's a lot of complex physics that goes into it. I mean, there's the wave function of all 26 electrons of the iron. I mean, it's not something that you can reduce to a simple function.
Okay. So, this is boring.
Of course there are intermediates, and in those pair potentials that people plug into one another simulations and get as different skills and properties in their feet are fine, they're no better than a show of the series. And in fact, you can show that there's a fundamental connection that every term is finding the same connection played to.
We've all kind of helped make the point for me, which is there are a lot of ways to do the expansion. There's not a lot of ways to take the fundamental physics and apply it to an equation of state, although people have tried doing all sorts of things. And so there's a huge literature of different formulations of Earth equations of state that have basically taken bits and pieces of what we've kind of all come up with together, different ways to solve a thermal equation of state for the Earth. And so there's some classic choices. One is Mie-Grunheisen-Debye equation of state, which connects kind of a microscopic understanding of the lattice behavior of a material and uses that information to expand out a thermal equation of state. And when you do that, the constitutive values turn out to be a Grunheisen parameter and a Debye temperature and a parameter for how they change with pressure, bulk modulus, shear modulus, and an initial density. Yeah. Right.
There should be a 2 for the last term. Because it's a mixed derivative.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. There's, yes, I just scribbled out an expansion. My point being that I like to cross off as many terms as possible at the end. There are simple equations of state, like the Holmes equation of state, which is what I showed you, that basically just has four parameters, an initial density, a bulk modulus, how it changes with pressure, and a thermal expansion. And then you assume that that product of thermal expansion and bulk modulus is constant. You can always add on terms and show how that product changes as you apply pressure. And then there's a new equation of state that just appeared in the literature within the last few months by Stacy, who that's probably contributed about half of the literature for equations of state, in which he chooses as his reference state the core itself. He says, well, we know that the core to first order is inner core, is pure iron. We have good seismic velocities for it. Let's use that to pin our equation of state down here at the bottom, okay? And then let's use our ambient measurements up at the top, and let's solve so that we're constrained at the two points, our seismic constraint and then our mineral physics constraint. And he uses that to design a complete new equation of state for the Earth. So there are lots of ways to do it. And then the question becomes, well, from a practical sense, what do you want? What do you need? And so this is what I call the experimenter's prerogative. Since an experimentalist makes the measurements, we get to decide, at least when the data are initially presented, how are we going to present the data? Which is why I like the practical equation of state, which just takes a complete thermal equation of state and breaks it down into a non-thermal part, the Birch-Moynihan equation of state, or however we choose to redefine that, plus the thermal pressure term at each pressure. And the reason I like this is because when I would choose how to expand the parameters in the reference state, the parameters would be chosen based on being as close as possible to what's actually physically measured in the measurement, okay? Knowing that when you take a measurement and you get out the values, anybody could take the whole data set and reformulate their descriptions of the equation of state as they please. But from a practical point of view, right now, we can't measure anything more than this. Okay? So all these go away. Yeah?
So I followed this loop for a while. It was good. It seems to me that the problem with this kind of approach is that if you start differentiating this thing, look at my order of properties, you're going to get inconsistencies in the relationship between, because this doesn't really, it won't be thermodynamically consistent.
Right.
Now,
that's why the Meagher and Eisen-Debye equation of state was developed, for to address exactly
the
that.
The thing that Lars is trying to get in place, if you want to expand your knowledge and working in that level, then you can make sure that everything is consistent, and you can use measurements of the peak capacity and everything else
Then I'll talk about that on Monday. Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah. I don't know that I'll be able to develop it like this, but.
Well, that's what I tell you what you can believe about.
No, I mean, we're flexible. I can bring that in earlier.
Okay, lunchtime.